Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Thanks for joining us, listeners. Today we have the privilege to have with us someone who is no stranger to Apologetics Canada, Dr. Craig A. Evans. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Evans.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you. I just have a little story to share before we jump into things, but I went to Trinity Western University at one point in time a few years back. I had the privilege to sit under you in a couple classes, but not only myself, but my brother also sat under you at Trinity Western University, and my dad took some courses from you at Acadia University in Nova Scotia. So our family has sat under you numerous times.
Oh, well, that's good, I guess.
and Terry tells me that you would come into class with no notes and lecture for 3 hours straight. He said it was unbelievable.
Well, you know, the first 30, 40 times it's tricky, but after that, you really got it down.
Yeah. Well, we were all enthralled, I tell you, when you got up there to speak, and we appreciated both the classes that I took with you.
Well, thank you.
All right, let's jump into things. Dr. Evans is a graduate of Claremont McKenna College. He received a Master's of Divinity from Western Baptist Seminary and his MA and PhD in Biblical Studies from Claremont Graduate University. He also has been awarded the D. Habil by Caroli Gaspar Reformed University. Dr. Evans has taught at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Trinity Western University in Langley, British Columbia for 21 years, and the Divinity College of Acadia University in Nova Scotia for 13 years. Dr. Evans now holds the John Bisagno Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins at Houston Baptist University in Texas. Dr. Evans is a New Testament scholar, prolific author, or editor of over 70 books and 600 journal articles. Is well known for his contribution to work on the Gospels, historical Jesus, Dead Sea Scrolls, and archaeology of the New Testament. Today we're going to discuss his new documentary, Fragments of Truth. Just take a listen right now.
Has Jesus been misquoted? How good are the manuscripts on which the New Testament is based? Where did we find them? Where are they housed today?
Normally these papyrus could last 300 or 400 years.
Some have said that the text has been deliberately changed. We're going to look at the actual text that survived from antiquity, and we're going to talk to the experts who know best.
The motivation for changing something in order to produce an effect is taken away because people don't know that one of those Gospels was going to become part of the Bible, part of something so substantial.
We want to get to the truth of it, to separate fact from fiction, sober scholarship from sensationalism. So join us in our quest for the fragments of truth.
Dr. Evans, what has motivated you to put out a documentary like this at this time?
Well, several reasons. One of them is that there have been some popular books and documentaries the last several years, last 20 years, suggesting that we don't know where some of the biblical books really came from, who wrote them. We don't know if the text has been well preserved. The text perhaps has been tampered with. Maybe Emperor Constantine chose the Gospels, you know, things like that. There's been skepticism relating to the text itself. It's been miscopied by ancient copyists, scribes who don't know what they're doing, or deliberately made changes to get the theology right, whatever that means. So there's been this kind of stuff out and about in the public, usually at a popular level. And, you know, scholars ignore it typically. You know, we hear that kind of stuff and we don't pay any attention to it usually. And then also at the same time, I've noticed in the church, lay people don't really know much about where the Bible comes from and can they trust the modern editions and translations that they read? Do they really reflect the original? That kind of question. And even clergy don't know how to answer that very well. So these were all the factors that came into play. We continue to find old manuscripts and fragments and so on from the countless papyri from antiquity that have been recovered but not yet published. older manuscripts and so on. And we just wanted to set the record straight. So I suggested this documentary a few years ago, and Faith Life in Bellingham, Washington said, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's make a documentary. So we did that, and that's why we did it. And so we went to the places where the oldest manuscripts are kept in Europe. We interviewed the scholars, the textual critics, the papyrologists, the museum curators who know best. So that's what's behind it. So I didn't want to just give my opinion. I wanted to talk to all the experts and look at the evidence. And that's what the documentary has done.
During that journey, is there anything that you learned? Was there anything that surprised you?
There were a few surprises. I mean, obviously, I've studied this myself a lot. And I've done some work on, like, the longevity, how long the originals, the autographs, how long the earliest copies were in circulation. That's been a big surprise to a lot of viewers, but it was no surprise to me because I've been working in that area for almost 10 years. But one of the big surprises to me, I hadn't really thought about it this way, and it was made by some of the people we interviewed. I'm thinking of Simon Gathercall at Cambridge, and also Peter Williams at Tyndale House, which is also in Cambridge. Both of them made the point that it would be impossible for a scribe to change the text, say one of the Gospels, to portray Jesus differently, change his teaching or something like that, and then get away with it, because you'd have to change hundreds of texts in different places and in different languages, because the text originated in Greek, the Greek Gospels, but very quickly were translated into Latin and other languages. And so the idea of somebody rigging the text and giving us a different Jesus, and somehow that doesn't get noticed and it ends up widespread in all the manuscripts, is simply impossible. And the other surprising thing to me was that why would anyone make a change like that, say, in the first century or even in the second century, because they don't know what orthodoxy is going to be, if you know what I mean. They don't Right. know what are the changes they ought to make, given the theological interests of the church in the fourth century. So the whole thing is anachronistic and is simply impossible. And I had not thought it through like that before. And so in interviewing some of these scholars and hearing this, I realized, my goodness, the case that supports the integrity of the text, our view that the text really does reflect what the gospel writers wrote, is even stronger than I had suspected. So for me personally, that was one of the surprises, and it was a really good thing, and I hope it comes through clearly in the film.
Now, this would be one of those questions where maybe people are wondering, well, you know, why is it important that we know when these documents were written? But this would play into that, wouldn't it? I mean, if they're written later, then somebody could try to make that argument. But if these documents were written earlier, then that argument would hold. Does that make sense?
Oh, of course it does. And that's one of the reasons why scholars who talk about the historical Jesus have respect for the Gospels, is because they're written within a generation of the events. And most historical documents from antiquity are that way, the ones that scholars take seriously. So classical scholars read the Greek histories and the Latin histories, and they have criteria for evaluating them in terms of authenticity and reliability and that sort of thing. And the New Testament Gospels meet those criteria very well. We have multiple accounts. They're early accounts. We have, of course, numerous manuscripts, early copies, fragmentary copies, complete copies, and so on. So we're really talking about two things. We're talking about how well preserved the text is. And the answer to that question is very well preserved. And then the other question is, well, does the text really reflect what Jesus said and did? In other words, is it early? Does it reflect the realities of the world of Jesus? That's what's called verisimilitude. That's what historians look for. Does it really reflect the realities of the person and context being described? And again, the answer there is yes, it does. Which is why archaeologists use, and I mean Israeli archaeologists, by the way, not just Christian archaeologists, use the Gospels because they find them reliable. They know where to dig and how to interpret what they dig up. And archaeologists don't use bogus sources, unreliable sources. They have to use sources that pay off because archaeology is expensive, it's labor-intensive, it's time-consuming. You don't want to dig in the wrong spot, or you don't want to dig something up and then you have no idea what you're looking at. You rely on reliable sources, and the Gospels are that way. So these are all the factors that come into play, and this is why people should have confidence that when they're reading the New Testament Gospels, they're reading the text the way it was written in the first century, and they're reading Gospel narratives that actually know what they're talking about. They're talking about the real Jesus and what he actually said and did.
On that note, I'd love to hear, what would you date the New Testament to? And then give us a couple arguments for why you would date it to that range.
Well, most of the New Testament books should be dated, maybe even all of them. I know there is some dispute over a few of them, but the four Gospels and Acts should be dated in the 60s and 70s. It's possible that one of them, you know, the earliest could be even in the 50s. I don't think they're as late as the 80s. So one way of saying it is the New Testament should be dated to the second half of the first century. In other words, from 50 to the 90s, that would pretty well cover all of it. And there, you know, there's Second Peter, and as sometimes is pushed into the second century. Sometimes even the pastoral letters, 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, sometimes they're pushed into the second century, but that's very much up in the air and being debated by scholars. That's not my area of expertise. But when it comes to the Gospels, I don't think there's any question that they're early, and they're in the first century. So they're not like some legendary account written 200 or 300 years after the time somebody lived. They're nothing like that. They're not like the apocryphal Gospels or the Gnostic Gospels that are 100 years later and aren't based on credible historical information. So I have great confidence in the New Testament Gospels. I think everybody should, not only because of the integrity and number and antiquity of the manuscripts, but also the archaeological confirmation as well.
Could you just give us a couple of those arguments that you think are most persuasive that lead you to date the New Testament at that time?
Well, sure. For the Gospels, and I'll stick with the Gospels mainly because Paul's letters aren't really disputed except for, say, the pastorals. Everybody agrees Paul wrote his letters as early as 49, the late 40s, early 50s, into the middle 60s. That's not much of a dispute. Where you get variations in date, it's usually relating to the Gospels. I've seen people try to argue that Luke's Gospel is written at, you know, AD 100 or something like that, and which I think is ridiculously too late. The reason we believe the Gospels are early, there's external corroboration. We actually have somebody writing in the early second century, Papias, and he's talking about the Gospels. He's quoting them. He's referring to them. Well, that would not be possible if the Gospels hadn't been written yet or were of such recent vintage. How would they acquire such authority? So Papias talks about Matthew and Mark. He quotes from Acts. We don't have all of his writings. He refers to John. There's no way he would be talking about them as recognized authoritative in the year 120 unless they've been around at least one generation. So Papias's conversation and talk about them supports that. We also have other writings that are outside the New Testament that quotes them. So there's a letter called First Clement written in the 90s. This author is familiar with Matthew and John. You get the same thing with Ignatius writing about 15 years later. He writes several letters. He's familiar with the Gospels. So this, it just isn't possible for the Gospels to have that kind of recognition widespread. I mean, there's nobody in the second century that seems confused about which Gospels are authoritative. They always refer to Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the four New Testament Gospels. There doesn't seem to be any confusion on that point at all. We have not found an early Greek New Testament that has a different set of Gospels in it. So these are all the factors that come into play. But also, as I mentioned, Gospels that are late, like the Gnostic Gospels, spurious Gospels that don't have any relationship to the apostles who knew Jesus, they make mistakes. They don't reflect the realities of the early first century in Israel, the realities that archaeologists uncover and document. So that's all the more reason for seeing Matthew, Mark, Luke, John as, in fact, early, connected to apostolic eyewitness tradition, and reliable, which, again, is why archaeologists make use of them.
I know that you've been involved in a number of archaeological digs in the last couple of years. One of the charges that the skeptic gives is a lack of evidence of, you know, character and places within the Bible. What important archaeological finds have contributed to establishing the reliability of the New Testament and the life of Jesus?
Okay, there are two points that need to be made. The skeptics sometimes don't understand the nature of antiquity and what we have to work with. What they do is they simply expect too much. They expect to find Jesus's name carved in stone all over the place. They expect non-Christians to be talking about Jesus. It's kind of naive. It's like the fame that Jesus acquires by the fourth century should have been the general fame that he enjoyed in the first century. They just, some of these skeptics are not, they're just not good historians. They don't understand that kind of thing. They'll say, well, if Jesus really was so special, the Son of God, a miracle worker, why don't we have more sources talking about him in the first century? But if they just stop and think for a minute, Jesus compares rather well with the Roman emperors, as a matter of fact. And so when you put it into perspective, you realize, you know, Jesus is very much talked about. So what is some of the evidence besides the four New Testament Gospels? Well, the Christians and Jesus are referenced by early second century Roman historians. They don't like the Christians. They don't respect the Christians, but they know who they are. And what they tell us corroborates and supports what we actually have in the Gospels. But we do have some archaeological evidence. We have, for example, a magician's cup. It's a magic cup, a ceramic cup. It was probably made in 100 BC, and in the middle of the first century AD, somebody actually scratches into it, you know, Christ, and so suggesting that the magician gets his power through Christ. Now, why would a magician do something like that in the middle of the first century? Well, he does that because he's heard of this individual, this Jewish person called Jesus Christ, who can perform miracles and cast out evil spirits and heal people. And so even though this magician isn't a Christian, obviously, he's eclectic. He will accept whatever information and power and magic he can get from whatever source. He's heard about this Jesus. Well, that's a very significant evidence. And a historian looks at that and thinks, wow, this Jesus is so well known. Somebody in Egypt, a magician, wants to appeal to Jesus' name. Now, we see that in other archaeological evidence as well. So that's the kind of stuff we look at. And so the idea that Jesus didn't exist, or that the Gospels weren't written for until the second century, just doesn't make any sense, because there's too much evidence talking about Jesus early on.
You know, speaking of archaeology, you spoke at the Apologetics Canada conference a number of years ago. I don't know if you remember that, but you talked about a fragment from the Book of Mark that was found in an ancient Egyptian, I believe, burial mask. And that ended up actually getting a lot of online attention. If you remember when that whole thing exploded, we got our fair bit of publicity from that just because they kept citing your talk at our conference. In the documentary, talking about this this fragment, what's become of it for those that were at the conference who maybe haven't followed up with all that?
Sure, I'm happy to update you on that. You know, it's been interesting to see that in the media. I've been interviewed many times. I get contacted by media people all the time. I get endless email asking for updates, and it is frustrating. I wish they would publish the fragment and settle it once and for all. I do want to make clear one thing. The fragments and other fragments like it have been recovered from what is called cartonnage. That's like paper mache, and paper mache went into these mummy masks, also the bodice, you know, the body. Sometimes it's just stuffing inside a mummy and things like that. And so the mark fragment probably didn't come from a mask, but I did talk about masks just to illustrate that, because I've seen masks deconstructed and papyrus with writing on it recovered. But what the exact source is for this fragment is actually not known. It probably wasn't a mask. We're not even sure it was cartonnage. It's hard to say. But here's the update that I can give you. Yes, it was claimed 7 years ago. It was leaked, and it wasn't supposed to be leaked. But 7 years ago, it was leaked out that there was a late first century fragment of the Gospel of Mark. Anyway, I know the people who are studying it. There is a confidentiality requirement because the people studying it don't own it. It's linked to the Museum of the Bible, but the Museum of the Bible and the Steve Green family, they don't own it, though the owner has tried to sell it to them, but they've decided not to purchase it. So this is what I can tell you. It is an old fragment. It is late first century, as we've always said. But the real question is it really the Gospel of Mark? And so there was a lot of confidence several years ago that it was, but after talking to people who have seen it personally, they're not sure that it is Mark. So there is a scholar in Oxford that has it in his possession. He is the one I assume will eventually publish it. He thinks it is Mark, which that would be quite a thing if that turns out to be correct. But I've also talked to others who have seen it, and they say they just aren't sure at all. And here's the bottom line for me personally. If it is Mark, if all you have are a few letters, maybe at most a few words, that doesn't solve anything. Nobody questions the fact that the Gospel of Mark was written in the first century. So it is theoretically possible we could find a piece of it, a piece of a very old copy that dates to the first century. You know, that's possible. I mean, obviously, there were copies of Mark circulating in Egypt and elsewhere at the end of the first century. It isn't going to solve any question about the text. It isn't going to say, see, the text of Mark has no mistakes in it or whatever. A fragment that small that contains not even a full verse isn't really going to shed much light on anything. So what it is, it's an artifact of great interest. It might set the record and be the first fragment, only fragment thus far discovered that dates to the first century. But in terms of real questions that are important, like the integrity of the text and that kind of thing, this fragment's not going to solve that. So for now, I don't talk about it. That's why the Fragments of Truth documentary didn't say anything about it. We learned that. We didn't bother interviewing the scholar in Oxford who has it, because there was really nothing to say about it. And so we had other things to talk about. We didn't want to deal with speculation and uncertainties. We wanted to look at the old fragments whose date and identification are certain and work with that kind of material.
On that note, what is the earliest fragment? But on top of that, what's the earliest complete manuscript that we have? What do they date to?
Okay, well, we have two very early fragments of the Gospels. One of them is P52. The P stands for papyrus. And they're all, as Greek New Testament papyri are discovered, they're numbered, P1, P2, and so on. We're all the way up to papyrus 134, by the way. But P52 was identified back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, in through there. And it's a small part of John's Gospel, chapter 18, front side, back side, verses 31 to 33, and on the flip side of the page, 37 and 38, just portions of those verses. And it is dated with confidence to just before the middle of the second century. Some date it as early as 120 or 130. I don't think anyone dates it later than 150. So it's our oldest fragment of the Greek New Testament. There's another one almost as old. It's three small fragments of Matthew, chapter 26. Those fragments are in Oxford. P52 is up north in Manchester, and this other fragment, P64, at Magdalen College in Oxford, and they date perhaps as early as 160 or 180. Now, when you ask about the oldest complete manuscript, you don't have the entire New Testament until you get to the 4th century, the complete New Testament in any one single manuscript, and we have two. Codex Vaticanus, which actually is missing some documents, Hebrews, for example, part of it, and also Codex Sinaiticus from St. Catherine's Monastery. It's in the British Museum, so you can go see those. And so when you get to the 4th century, we have codices, ancient books that have the entire text. But earlier than that, if you go back into the say the late 3rd century, early 4th century, we have substantial portions of the New Testament. We can reconstruct almost the whole of the New Testament from these other papyri.
Now, on that note, when you are filming this documentary and you are going to where these fragments and manuscripts are held, how difficult was it to get access to the fragments?
It was difficult in various ways. Usually, you know, we contacted people months in advance to get permission, fill out forms. We actually had to have insurance on one case. It was $1 million policy, if you can believe it.
Wow.
You know, it was, yeah, to be insured for $1 million for just a few hours. It was one of the most unusual things, and compensate the museum in the event somehow using our equipment we destroyed the fragment. It was kind of strange. So they're just different costs. And so because we were willing to pay fees, have insurance, things like that, we got permission. Some of these things, of course, anybody can see. You just walk into the museum and there we are. And so we were getting permission simply to bring our equipment into the museum and film. It wasn't permission to see it. It was just permission to do all that kind of work. In some cases, it was both getting permission to see it, but also getting permission to film it, because it's under lock and key in a dark climate controlled vault that protects it. P52 in Manchester, you know, anybody can see it. You just walk in and look at it. There it is. But we had to get permission to film it. So it's a variety of things like that. Now, the Vatican was the most difficult. The Vatican is very secretive. It was hard to get permission, hard to get in there and see things. There were a lot of restrictions. There were things that we could look at in person, but we could not film, and things that we couldn't say. And so I have to respect that even in this interview.
I was going to ask that if there was any fragments that you did not get access to or you weren't granted access to.
Yeah, there were some limitations at the Vatican, also at the British Museum. We wanted to look at Codex Sinaiticus and film it, and they simply would not grant permission. I don't know why. And Sinaiticus is always on display. You can look at it, but they wouldn't take it out of the display case and let us handle it, leaf through it. But we looked at Codex Bezae, which is almost as old as Sinaiticus. It dates to about the year 400, which would make it probably 50, 60 years newer. And it's at Cambridge, in the Cambridge University Library. We had permission and spent an entire day. I held it in my hands. I turned the pages. We filmed it. So it's just different. Now, we looked at P66, which is an almost complete copy of the Gospel of John, dates to about 200 AD, and it's in Geneva, Switzerland at the Bodmer Museum. And we couldn't touch it. I mean, it was on the table. We could look at it. I had my face within inches of it. But we couldn't even touch it. We couldn't lift and move one page. It's very fragile. And so it was fascinating to see it. So, you know, place to place, they have their different restrictions. That's just the way it is.
The New Testament documents have become the best attested texts in the world compared to other ancient writings. I think we've have more than 25,000 New Testament manuscripts dating within like 150 years of the originals, I think. And then I also heard, and this is just something I heard a while back, that there's other letters and documents that even if all the biblical New Testament documents were destroyed, we could still practically create the New Testament again by these extra-biblical manuscripts. Is this somewhat accurate?
That's correct. Let me restate a few things, though some people listening to what you just said might misunderstand something. We have about 5,800 handwritten manuscripts of the Greek New Testament. They're not all whole. Many of them are partial. Some of these are just the Gospels or just the Epistles. But 5,800 or so handwritten, that's what manuscript means. And most of those are medieval. We do have a dozen or so fragments that are in the second century. The number increases when we get into the third century and so forth. So yes, it is. It is the best attested, best witnessed document from antiquity. We have 800 manuscripts of Homer. Homer was like scripture to the Greeks. But when you start talking about other writings, historians like Herodotus, Thucydides, Tacitus, Polybius, and others, and the number of manuscripts shrinks down to 10, 12. The oldest manuscript might be 1,000 years removed in time from when the original was written. And so, yes, the New Testament in comparison is dramatic and very well attested. We also have 10,000 copies of the New Testament in Latin, handwritten copies. That brings us up to 15,000. And then we have several thousands more of in other languages. So that's where you're getting a number like 20, 25,000 manuscripts, and that's correct. And so the New Testament record is just staggering in comparison to the other ancient manuscripts from the ancient world.
If people want to watch this documentary, Fragments of Truth, what would be the best way for them to get a hold of it?
Okay, that's going to be announced on the Faith Life webpage, Faith Life. One, like it's one word, faithlife.com. There was an agreement with Fathom Events that released it in the 741 theaters across the United States last month. That is, for 3 months, it cannot be available. So, you know, the theaters wanted to be able to claim that they had an exclusive presentation of it. And so that's the contract. And so it's been a month. So in 2 months, Faith Life will be letting everybody know how they can access it, either online, purchase DVD. I'm not sure exactly how. It may be on television at some point down the road. I'm not sure. But they're honoring that agreement, and so they're not saying anything. I know that's frustrating because I get contacted all the time. Hey, I didn't see it at the theater, or I did see it and I want to see it again and take notes. There was so much stuff. Wow. And that's all I can tell them is, well, you have to wait a couple more months and then we will all be told how we can access it and see it in the future.
Well, I think we're going to wrap it up there for today. Thank you, Dr. Evans, for being on the podcast with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. I enjoyed it very much.
Where can listeners find more about you and your writings?
Well, you can always visit my own webpage, craigaevans.com. My schedule is there, books that have been published, other things, so people can check me out that way.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more things to think about.